Good morning. It is 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 27th, and you are listening to the Kenai Conversation on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and we are going on an adventure today. The KDLL Adventure Talks program is back, and we're tagging along somewhere very remote this month. We are here with Dr. Kristen Mitchell, who practices at Peninsula Internal Medicine in Soldotna. And editor's note, she's also a member of the KDLL board, though that is not why she is here today. We are happy to have her back in the community from a pretty cool trip. Literally cool. I promise that's the last time I'm going to make that joke today. So where have you been, Dr. Mitchell?
I just returned from almost a month in Antarctica on the Antarctic Peninsula with a group of 80 women scientists.
So Alaskans, when they get out of Alaska in the winter, generally tend to be more Hawaii-bound rather than Antarctica-bound. So what brought you to Antarctica?
So I have always been inspired by wild and challenging places, and I've have read stories about Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton particularly, and so I have long thought that I would love to go to Antarctica, but didn't really want to go as a tourist and hadn't quite figured out how that might happen. And actually about a year and a half ago, I was invited to be on a science panel by the Cook Inlet Keeper. And on that panel was Sue Magger, who is the scientist for Cook Inlet Keeper. And she was about to embark on the Homeward Bound journey last year. So she went to Antarctica. She was a couple months away from leaving. And I was so inspired by her adventures that I said, wow, you know, could I do this? And she said, yep, applications close in 2 weeks. So I put together an application and I thought, I'm not really a scientist. I'm just a doctor. They won't really want me to do it. It's not a big commitment because it won't happen. And then I was chosen to be part of the third cohort. So over the past year or so, we've been preparing to go on the Antarctic journey. And on New Year's Eve, we left for my seventh continent.
What great timing, too, to embark on a journey, New Year's Eve. I hope it wasn't too reminiscent of Amundsen or Shackleton or any of those journeys.
We had much better food. We were very well taken care of on the ship. We did not have to eat our dogs or our ponies. So all those things were good.
Excellent. Well, good. Dr. Mitchell is going to share photos, videos, and stories from her journey in a live presentation tomorrow night, Thursday, February 28th, at 6:30 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. It's free for KDLL members or $5 for non-members. I've seen some of her photos already, and they are amazing, so I highly encourage people to come to that presentation. It is guaranteed to be the most comfortable way to get a first-hand look at Antarctica, as we will have coffee and tea and a climate-controlled room. So we're going to save a lot of the stories from her journey for Thursday night, and today we're talking about how you got to Antarctica. So what is Homeward Bound? It's a fairly new thing. I'd heard of Sue doing it as well, but that's the first I'd ever come across it. So what is the program? What is the goal? What are they hoping to accomplish?
So Homeward Bound is a project that was dreamt up literally by a woman named Fabian Dottner, who is in Australia. And she has been a leadership coach in executive leadership for a long time. And she was working with some of the women in the Australian Antarctic Division and was a little discouraged about the barriers they were meeting in their careers and their barriers to advancement and not being able to achieve the things that they were hoping to achieve. And she literally had this dream that she would have 1,000 women in Antarctica and train them all to be leaders around leadership around the Antarctic continent and around climate change in general. And she ran it by a couple of friends and they said, you know what, that's actually a good idea. And so she put together this initiative. And so there have been, the first groups were about 78, 80 women. The future groups will be about 120 women. But over a decade, the goal is to train 1,000 women scientists in leadership in hopes that we will be able to have more women at the leadership table, particularly around climate change, but around scientific issues in general.
And why Antarctica for this? I mean, it seems like logistically it'd be easier to have a science meeting in San Diego or something.
So I think there are a couple of different reasons for Antarctica. Partly, it is a place that inspires people, and it is similar to Alaska for some people, that it is wild and far away and a little bit out of reach, and I think that inspires the imagination. And partly also because it is so far away, we were completely offline. We didn't have connection with the internet. We didn't have connection with our families, friends, work, all the things that distract us all the time. So we were able to really spend 3 weeks immersed in this leadership project and pay attention to what was in front of us. And that, I think, makes a big difference in terms of being able to be fully present and really be part of the project.
Right. And this is for women in STEM is the term du jour at the moment. So what version of acronym of STEM does this involve?
So lots of scientists, lots of PhD level scientists, technology for sure. There were quite a number of engineers in a variety of realms. So, and the technology, there were some people who were like digital mappers and people who were really interested in geography. There are engineers who are developing tidal systems to develop tidal energy in Scotland. Not a lot of mathematics, although kind of a disproportionate number of astrophysicists.
Really? Was, yeah. Interesting.
It was interesting. So the first woman astrophysicist from Pakistan was on our journey together, and she was amazing. She had a great talk about how in the Big Bang there was so much dust that was generated by the Big Bang that we all walk around with a little bit of stardust on us.
And oh, nice.
Dust the stardust nice. Off. So that was an inspirational talk. And then there's another astrophysicist who works in Australia who was part of the Nobel Prize winning team that described gravitational waves.
Oh, dang.
So she had a great presentation about gravitational waves and had some sound effects of what gravitational waves sound like when you have two black holes that collide. So that was... We all got schooled in gravitational waves, which is not something I expected to learn in Antarctica.
Yeah, I was just excited to hear your video clip of the penguins purring. I can't even imagine trying to figure out what gravitational waves sound like. And so you are coming from medicine, which is mm-hmm. one of the M's as well,
yes.
I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So for folks who might not be aware of you or haven't met you, what is your background and how did you come to find yourself in Soldotna in the medical field?
So I trained in internal medicine at the University of Washington, and when I was there, I heard about a group in Soldotna that trained residents and was great and mentors and helped people learn all about internal medicine and that it was a wide-ranging practice and that people really got to use all of the skills that they had learned in residency training, and I thought that would be a super fun thing to do. Maybe I'll go up to Alaska for a couple years and then rejoin civilization.
Oh, one of those. I'm just going to go for a couple years.
Right.
Sure you are.
So 20 years later, civilization has not called loud enough to call me back. And actually, on board ship, we were invited to do a symposium at sea. So one of the things I talked about was in the 2 years I was here, I built a house, I built a family, I built a medical practice, and I just decided there was a lot keeping me here. And that my quality of life in Alaska was rich and wonderful in a way that I was not seeing that be so true for people who were practicing medicine back in the big city.
Right.
So I practice internal medicine at Peninsula Internal Medicine. I have a stellar group of colleagues who challenge me every day to think about things in new and complex ways, who are great to bounce questions and ideas off of, who I absolutely trust if I am gone in Antarctica to take good care of my patients, which is really a big deal in medicine, to have colleagues that you trust enough that you can have a little bit of personal time off and know that your patients will still get excellent care. And then I also teach for the University of Washington. So I run the third year medical student clerkship in Soldotna with Dr. Pokorny, and I teach residents as well.
And you must have a bent toward adventuring as well, if Antarctica appeals to you. Has that been a lifelong thing, or did you suddenly get outdoorsy when you came to Alaska?
I think it's kind of been a lifelong thing. It was my parents were adventurers a little bit. They were competitive sailors when I was very young, and actually gave that up because friends of theirs were lost at sea when I was 4 years old, and my mother decided that competitive sailing was not in the cards as a young mom. But we did a lot of hiking together as a family. In fact, one of the things we were invited to do as part of this journey to link us back to our support systems was to ask friends and family to write us letters. And so my dad wrote me a letter about this hike that we took together when I was young. And my recollections of that hike was it was the first time I was allowed to use a real grown-up camera. And so we went hiking on this very challenging hike in the Kings Canyon area in California. And it was probably a hike, he said in his letter, he should not have taken a 9-year-old on. But anyhow, there we were scaling mountains, and we got up to this lake that had ice floating in it. And he decided he needed to swim in the lake. So he gave me the camera and dove out and swam underneath this floating iceberg and then came up on the other side, which seemed like a long time later, and yelled at me to push the shutter. And that was my first formal photograph. So I think adventure has been part of my family life for a long time. And I've often had the sense of this might be my last chance to travel or do something. So throughout medical training and residency, I was fortunate to explore a lot of different places. But I'd never been to Antarctica, and I'm really glad that I got to go.
That's such a, it seems unreachable. I mean, it's obviously not, but logistically, not exactly hop in one plane to get there.
It took about 40 hours to get there from Kenai. I'm proud of myself that I went skiing with my son on Christmas Day before I got on the airplane. And then I was swimming in Tierra del Fuego.
That is pretty crazy as far as the, so what did you do with your Christmas vacation? Well, let me tell you about the penguins.
Yeah, well, it actually, on the way back from Antarctica, I came through Minneapolis to visit my son in college. And it was much colder in Minneapolis than it was in Antarctica. This was even just before the big polar vortex, but yeah, it was, the temperatures in the summer on the Antarctic Peninsula are pretty similar to winter temperatures in Alaska. So we had a lot more daylight, and it, for me, it felt actually pretty warm.
Okay. So you applied for this program, not really sure that you're probably not really thinking you were going to get it. What happened when you, was it a letter in the mail? Was it an email? Was it a phone call? How did you find out that this was actually going to be a thing for you?
So it was an email. Because there were women from 23 different nationalities, there nobody's in the same time zone. So a lot of email and virtual communication associated with Homeward Bound. And so shortly after we were all chosen, we started on our monthly Skype calls. And so there would be two calls every day, one at 9 a.m. Australia time and one at 5 p.m. Australia time, to sort of wrap everybody around the globe into calls. And so we would meet and talk about the different leadership initiatives and some of the program work that we would be looking forward to doing on the ship. We talked about logistics. We talked about just a whole variety of topics that might have come up. So we got a little bit of a chance to see each other on screen, although it's hard to get to know very much about 40 people in a hour-long phone call.
Right, yeah. And when did you find out that you were going to be going?
I think it was September. It was towards the end of the summer of last year. So we had about a year of lead-up before we got onto the ship.
Okay. And what does the program entail before you actually go on the trip? What are they doing with you? What are the expectations of their participants?
So it's a leadership initiative. So one of the big things was something called a lifestyles inventory, or LSI, which is it's kind of a self-reflection about how do you approach different situations? What's your leadership style? And there is a portion of that where you ask people who work closely with you to also reflect on what your leadership style is. And then looking at that information, there's a lot of research about how those different styles are more effective or less effective in different situations, and the kinds of things that an individual might do to enhance their helpful characteristics and maybe not focus so much on some of the tendencies that might make us less effective. So we did that, and then had a coach who helped us interpret those results and think about what those implications might mean before we got together on the ship. And then we used that information in a lot of leadership sessions once we were together on board.
And did you find out anything about yourself that kind of surprised you, or that you realized you wanted to work on?
Absolutely. And there's, I think any really deep dive leadership journey involves a lot of vulnerability and sort of looking at things that we might not be so excited about looking at about ourselves.
That we might not be so excited to ask our colleagues to tell us about ourselves.
Exactly. So I think one of the things that was helpful was thinking about using all of that feedback from colleagues and really recognizing that that is a gift, as an opportunity to grow and to be more effective, and that anybody who spent the time thinking seriously about us and giving us that sort of feedback really was helping in a constructive way to help us be more effective. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about what is, you know, an ideal mentor or an ideal boss or an ideal colleague look like, and how do they act, and thinking about, I don't always act that way. So what keeps me from doing that? I think one of the things that was true for me is that I tend to see myself and other people tend to see me as a perfectionist and someone who has really high standards and really doesn't settle for second rate, and that at times that can be an advantage and at times that can be a barrier to just moving forward and saying, you know, this is good enough, let's go skiing or let's go play or let's move forward or we'll revise this as needed in the future. So I know that I'm working on that. It will continue to be a work in progress for a long time.
You should spend some time in journalism. We're all about as good as you can do in the time and with the resources allotted. Yeah. And then move on to the next thing. So that process took about a year. Mm-hmm. Were there other things that they had you working on before the trip?
So Homeward Bound is running several different cohorts somewhat simultaneously. So Sue's group was getting ready to leave on their ship just as we were being chosen. And there are a lot of the Homeward Bound leadership and faculty team are volunteers. So there are not as many of them as there are participants.
Okay.
So I found that in the first couple months, there was all this energy and anticipation of having gone through a pretty rigorous selection process and thought hard about why would I want to do this? And then most of the energy of the leadership was understandably directed towards getting the journey that was about to embark on ship ready. And then they were all gone together for a month in Antarctica. So one of the things I did was I started a book club amongst the people who were going on my Homeward Bound journey. So that was something that was just, it was something that we did. And so we looked at what do we want to read about? And so we read some Shackleton and we read some Scott stories and some kind of historic Antarctica. And we read some things from Rachel Robertson, who was an Australian leader. She's the first woman leader of the Australian Antarctic base. And she had a lot of really very thoughtful reflections about what does it mean to lead a group of people in a remote place where you can't send someone home for bad behavior or you can't get additional help if someone needs help. And how do you negotiate some of the factions or the sectionalism or tribalism that can happen in a group of people who are understandably under stress
right.
for a long time. So she had some great stories and some great takeaway leadership moments. So we enjoyed reading that. We read some fiction. So I think we all learned some things in terms of background about Antarctica before we went through the book group. And I think ultimately the biggest thing we took away from that was it was a smaller group of people that got together and talked in general about the books and the literature, but also what our hopes and fears were about Antarctica. So by the time we got there, we felt like we knew each other pretty well.
Nice. Okay. And you said there are representation from 23 countries, isn't mm-hmm. it right?
Yes.
So this is open to what, anyone in the world from anywhere? Do they recruit? Is this, I mean, how do people come to this program?
So I heard about it from Sue, and I think a lot of people have heard about it from word of mouth, people who are colleagues in science or mentors or someone who's been taught by someone who's been there. So there definitely is a kind of a web network, which leads, I think, to there being a little bit heavier representation from Australia, because that's where it started.
Right.
And it is open for applications to anyone involved in science, technology, engineering, medicine, math, who is interested in being part of a transformational leadership program and wants to be part of the conversation, particularly around climate change, but about women in leadership generally. And there's a real interest in broadening the representation from women in parts of the globe that have not been as fully represented in earlier cohorts. So particularly if there are women with a background in Africa or in Asia, that those are two areas of the world that Homeward Bound would really actively like to have more women represented.
Okay. As you mentioned earlier, this isn't just for people who've been established in their career for a while. I mean, there's diversity from people in different cultures and different areas of the world, but also in age, it sounds like.
That was one of the really most valuable and most surprising things to me on the journey, is that there were women as young as 23, 24 who had just finished university and were embarking on a career in science. There were women throughout the age range and women in their late 60s who were closing out an illustrious career in science or in teaching. And I think we all approached things on the ship from a very egalitarian standpoint, that we were all trying to learn about ourselves and learn how to be more effective leaders wherever we were in our careers. And I think those of us who have been at this a little longer realized we had a lot to learn from the younger generation that is so technologically savvy and knowledgeable. And I think a lot of the younger people reflected that it was inspirational to be able to just sit down at lunch with someone who had a professor status at a university that normally they'd be intimidated by, and instead they could just have an interesting conversation about the penguins that we had seen together or something else. So the age diversity was a real richness of the program that I frankly hadn't anticipated and was pleasantly surprised about.
Yeah, that is a great leveler in one sense to all be on the same ship and the same, what 15-foot seas, 30-foot seas, what ridiculous, what was the passage?
12 meters, so that works out probably to 38,
I think. Yeah.
Big, really big.
Yeah, hard to have much divisions when you're all sloshing around in that same stuff.
Yeah.
Did you meet anyone in particular that you were maybe a little starstruck by or just surprised by or connected with that you wouldn't have ever have thought that that's a person that I'm going to have or collaborate with in my life?
Oh, I can't really point to just one. There was a lot of star power on the ship. I think I don't spend a lot of time hobnobbing with people who are part of Nobel Prize winning teams in Soldotna, Alaska. So just the overall caliber of the women on the ship was really outstanding, and that was a real privilege. One of the people that that I spent a lot of time with is actually, she lives in Belgium, and she is the EU representative on the International Whaling Commission. And she and I had a couple of late night conversations about whale strike allocations before we got on the ship together, because it's obviously a big interest in Alaska as well. And so she has been at international negotiations that make decisions about who gets what strike rights. And so I was a little starstruck by her, and then also realized that she is, she's just an amazingly warm, empathetic, interesting person with her own human story. And she's much more than the title that she sits with at the Whaling Commission. In fact, there's kind of a funny story. I had acquired a bag in Antarctica that I planned to bring back for my daughter, and it got misplaced in the hostel that I was staying at on my way home. And then it was found again. And so I was back in the United States, and the hostel in Argentina said, well, we have it at the front desk, so you could just come get it, which was not going to happen. And so I put out a call on the WhatsApp group and the in this group of the 80 women scientists that had recently been in Antarctica. And I said, is there any chance anybody's still in the area? And she said, well, I don't know if this is going to be your best option, but if you don't have a backup plan, I'm going to be in a meeting in Kenya in May of the Whaling Commission, and there will be a representative from Buenos Aires, and there will also be a representative from Alaska. And so if you could get the bag to Buenos Aires, it could go to Kenya, and I could pass it off to the Alaskan representative. And I think that kind of problem solving, it was just, there were a number of people who stepped up who said, I have a sister who lives in another part of Argentina and she could hold it for me, and someone else from Mozambique who was still in town and she was going to pick it up for me. So I think that international collaboration can happen in surprising ways about science as well as about souvenir bags from Antarctica. And when you ask about star power, I think the faculty included Christiana Figueres, who was the architect of the Paris Climate Accord. And so she really she's internationally famous for having pulled together 195 countries to sign on to the 1.5 degree Celsius warming goal. And that when the more I think about what that achievement represents, it is highly improbable in the context that we had that we could get 195 countries around the world to agree on a goal that was that precise and that ambitious.
Right.
And she talked a lot about the process of how did she get people to compromise and come to the table and consider things. And she talks a lot about stubborn optimism is what fuels her journey in leadership. And I think we all have a lot to learn from that.
That's a good takeaway for any field that you're in. If you have a goal that seems perhaps a little insurmountable, how do you plan to get there? But also, how do you keep yourself motivated to get there when it seems like, ooh, yeah, that's a big rock to push up an awfully long hill?
And I think some of the takeaways after being on this journey is that often we don't have to push the rock all by ourselves. And that there
That's
are
true.
More people who can help push than we might recognize, that if we don't ask for help, we won't likely just have it show up. And I think being clear about what are our goals, what are we hoping to accomplish, and then really keeping that mission at the forefront and realizing that we can make some compromises around the edges, but compromising about what the real goal is probably not going to get us where we want to go.
Right. Okay. So switch gears a little bit and let's talk about the kind of logistics of the trip. So first of all, how does Homeward Bound exist? How is this funded? How do these trips happen?
So I'm not part of the leadership team, so I don't know all of the details. It is undergoing some reorganization to be, I think, formally a nonprofit for a variety of tax reasons in Australia that I don't completely understand. There, a lot of the coaching and the leadership training is volunteer, so the faculty volunteers their time to train the participants, and then participants all contribute to the cost of the voyage itself. And so there's a lot of fundraising by a lot of people that goes into trying to make the voyage possible. And so some people were sponsored by their universities, or if they have a business that was trying to groom leadership, then they might be sponsored that way. Some people self-funded themselves. Some people did some crowdfunding. There were definitely some creative schemes. A lot of people wrote postcards to people who had donated to their campaigns. And so there were people who were sending off dozens of postcards to various sponsors throughout the world.
Okay. And the trip itself, so how did you prepare for that? What was the travel like to get there? I mean, what do you pack for Antarctica?
So there's a lot of discussion about how we as a group could help the next group do a better job of packing. and how we could have it be more of a green journey and reduce our carbon impact overall. And I think there definitely were some lessons learned. One thing I took away is that Alaskans probably shouldn't take packing advice from Australians when they're going to cold places.
Good point.
So there was a lot of talk about bring more socks. You need lots and lots of socks. Bring at least 10 pairs of socks. I would say I did not wear 10 pairs of socks. I gave away pairs of socks to people who had dirty socks and couldn't find time to do their laundry. So definitely don't need 10 pairs of socks. The other thing about packing is that we may think we all speak English, but British English and Australian English and American English are pretty different languages, particularly when it comes to items of clothing.
Oh.
And so when people say pack 10 pants, in Australia, they're meaning 10 pairs of underwear. there were a variety of interesting communication challenges. So one person in Ireland said, really, if you just packed like you packed for a ski holiday, you'd be fine. And I think weather can certainly change quickly in Antarctica, and it could have been colder and windier than it was. But really having an outside layer that's waterproof, having some layers underneath and a couple layers on top and things that are preferably not down so that if they get wet, they'll still be fine. Hats and gloves being important layers. But really, I think, you know, at the end of it, I didn't need to get a whole lot of new gear because
you're in Alaska.
I'm in Alaska.
And you ski.
And I ski. I will say that we had an office Christmas party shortly before we left, and there's a tradition that the nursing staff gets a gift for the physician staff at the end of the year, and they chose really warm gloves that you can slip those hand warmers into. And that was a very nice gift to have.
That is. Well, that will be handy. Oh, man. Pun again. Sorry. I will press on. That will be handy even when you're home and out and about in Alaska. We are talking to Dr. Kristen Mitchell on KDLL Adventure Talks, which has taken over the Kenai conversation today. Please join Kristen for a live photo and video presentation with stories from her recent trip to Antarctica at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, February 28th, at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. It's free for KDLL members or $5 for non-members. We're going to take a short break, but please stay tuned for more from Kristen on the Homeward Bound program and how her journey came about. This is Adventure Talks on KDLL 91.9 FM.
Have you ever wondered how much fish we sell on the Kenai, or how much oil comes from here, what it's all worth, and what it all means? Well, we have too. That's why we created Econ 919, a weekly look at the Kenai Peninsula's economy, what makes it work, and who makes it work. Tune in each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for new numbers, emerging trends, and a bit of trivia. Econ 919, Friday mornings at 9 and again at 5, right here on KDLL, public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
Welcome back. You are tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, and this is KDLL Adventure Talks, which has taken over the Kenai conversation today. I'm Jenny Nyman, and I'm here with Dr. Kristen Mitchell, and we're hearing about the Homeward Bound program and how she came to be in Antarctica last month. And you can see more from Dr. Mitchell in a live photo presentation with stories from her trip at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, February 28th, at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. Thanks again for being here, Dr. Mitchell. So the trip down there, how exactly does one get from Soldotna, Alaska to Antarctica?
So I flew from Kenai to Anchorage, Anchorage to Seattle, Seattle to Atlanta, and then Atlanta to Buenos Aires, and Buenos Aires to Ushuaia, which is at the southern tip of Patagonia in Argentina. And from there, we got on the ship, the MV Ushuaia, and motored down across the Drake Passage over a day and a half of initially relatively flat seas, although I was sick anyway. And then on the way back, really pretty. Our Antarctic guide rated it as 7 out of 10, and we were trying to imagine what a 9 or a 10 might have been. Unsuccessfully, but they were big seas. Our ship's captain was very skilled, but had us leave early so that we could try and weave our way between two storms.
Oh,
so it could have been worse.
Yeah, the Drake Passage you hear of as one of those waterways in the world where seasoned captains get a little nervous if they're thinking about doing that. Kind of a roller coaster of an experience. So you had a home away from home on Homeward Bound. You pretty much lived on this ship, correct?
We did. We lived on the MV Ushuaia, which was actually built originally for NOAA in 1970, and it can hold 84 passengers, and it is 85 meters or 278 feet long.
Oh, okay. You guys had staterooms, and there's facilities and all that good stuff, or was it pretty tight quarters?
It was relatively tight quarters. There are a variety of staterooms. We actually switched halfway through so that people got to experience the smaller rooms and the larger rooms. My first room had bunk beds, and I couldn't quite touch both walls if I reached out, but close, which was a good thing because we had a lot of turbulence in the Drake Passage, so I always needed to hang on to something, like holding on to the sink, brushing teeth, and things like that. And the first rooms, actually, there was a bathroom shared between two rooms that had bunk beds. And you could lock the bathroom from inside. So sometimes if your bunkmates on the other side of the door forgot to unlock your door, you couldn't get to the bathroom.
No.
So the staterooms upstairs were a little bit larger, and I moved halfway through and I actually had a window where I could look out and see the seas rolling. And didn't have a bunk bed. So there were advantages to being in really close quarters with someone, and there were advantages to having a little bit more space to roll out. So this is not a 30-foot charter vessel. There was actually a 2-masted sailboat that sailed past us, not in the Drake Passage, that had an 8-person crew, and we were very impressed that they were down there. So there definitely are some sailing ships that people take down there. There were cruise ships. There are something like 13,000 cruise ship passengers that travel to the Antarctic Peninsula in a year, apparently. And the cruise ships are sort of similar size to what Docks and Seward, and our ship looked really tiny compared to them.
Okay.
Like our bridge was kind of at their lower deck.
Yeah. And before the ship took off, you had a little bit of time in Argentina, correct? Mm-hmm. What all did you do before you headed over?
So we had a couple days of leadership programming. So we got to know each other a little bit. We worked on sort of thinking about personal strategy, and we worked on some values work, and we talked about ground rules for the ship. So things like confidentiality and trusting each other and assuming that everybody came to the project with good intentions and listening to and providing feedback in a way that was full of generosity and good intention. So those sorts of ground rules, I think, were really helpful for us to start on the ship where we were all on the same page and really ready to trust each other and have a good positive experience. And because the Drake Passage happens about 6 hours after you get on the ship, it was really nice to have good feelings about each other before we were all seasick.
Okay. And then you're going to be sharing a lot of stories and photos in your live talk on the 28th. But generally, I don't want to steal your thunder too much, but what sorts of things were you doing when you were in Antarctica? You were staying on the ship, correct? But you got off and explored and experienced. So what all were you doing when you were down there?
So we probably spent 4 to 6 hours every day in leadership programming. And then we would have landings at different times throughout the ship. We actually had pretty adverse ice conditions in a lot of places. So there were places that we had hoped to get off the ship and land. And just because of the ice, it just wasn't safe to do that. So we spent more time on board than was initially anticipated. We were able to visit a number of scientific stations, the Great Wall Station from China, which usually doesn't have Western visitors, but we had a Chinese contingent of 7 scientists who arranged that for us. We got to visit 2 Argentinian bases. We went by the Palmer base, which is the U.S. base on the peninsula, and planned to land but couldn't because of the ice conditions. So the Palmer crew came to the ship and joined us and talked to us. And it was during the shutdown, so they were having some frustration because the scientists who were there couldn't get their permits stamped to go do their research that they had been planning on doing for sometimes years. So the scientists who were there were sort of stuck on base hoping that the government might reopen so that they could get their permits to go do their scientific research.
Wow. Exiled in Antarctica, unable to do your job.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the staff who were federal employees who were keeping the pumps running and feeding people that didn't have the option to go home. So they continued to work, but they were not drawing paychecks when they were down there either. So the shutdown reached all the way to Antarctica. And it was interesting because we were offline, so we didn't know whether or not the government had reopened until we met up with the U.S. crew.
So on some of your landings, you were hiking around. I think there's some swimming photos, I believe, that will surface. What kinds of things were you doing when you did manage to get off the ship?
So we visited a number of different penguin colonies. We visited Adélie and Gentoo and Chinstrap penguin colonies on different islands off of the Antarctic Peninsula. And then we did a fair number of not landings on land, but where we would get out in the Zodiacs and travel around a bay. And so we saw whales and seals and penguins kind of at their level from the Zodiacs.
Very cool. Did you have any experiences that particularly stood out for you? I'm sure you did, but what are maybe some of your top 2 or 3 things that you saw or got to do that just moments of like, I can't believe this is actually happening?
It's hard to pick just 2 or 3. I would say one really memorable experience, we hiked up to the top of a mountain on Danco Island that had a few penguins on it, amazing views of glaciers and icebergs and the Antarctic Peninsula. And we had made an agreement before we left that we would try and have a silent landing. And being on board ship with the engines running all the time and 80 women in small quarters, there was not a lot of quiet space. So to get up to the top of a mountain with 80 people and have everybody agree we're not going to take photos, there won't be any shutters clicking, nobody's going to adjust the Velcro on their down jackets or move at all because waterproof pants make a lot of noise. And so we were all up there and we actually managed to be silent in this amazing landscape. And as I was sitting there on the snow, just admiring the view, I heard something and I wasn't quite sure what it was. It sounded like heavy breathing. And I looked around and I realized that there were humpback whales that were breathing and surfacing in the bay in front of me. And it was just magical to know that they were there and I had seen them and there wasn't a guide or an expert or a scientist who said, look, look, they're the humpbacks. I just got to discover them all by themselves. So that was definitely a magical day. And you asked earlier about swimming. We had a swimming experience that was pretty memorable as well. I actually had a little bit of, she's the girl from Alaska. She's used to cold water. And when we first were in Argentina, there was beautiful water just outside the hotel where we were having our conference. And I thought, I'll swim. And it wasn't that cold. So So then somebody else joined me. And so then pretty soon there were a couple of us swimming in the mornings. So I had this kind of cloud of, ooh, this is the cold water swimmer. And there's actually a woman from Ireland who regularly swims in cold water with a group. So then we had about 2.5 weeks where we didn't swim at all because we were in Antarctica and you couldn't just jump off the boat and swim. So we got to a place called Deception Island that is it's a volcano where the cone has collapsed in. And so inside the cone, it's quite sheltered and there still is some volcanic activity. So there's some pockets where the sand and the water is a little bit warmer. So we did a polar plunge where most of the women from the ship all jumped into the water and swam. And it was cold.
Way to represent Alaska. Yeah. How cold? Do you have any estimate?
So probably 2 degrees Celsius, which is 2 degrees above freezing. So 36, something like that.
Yeah. That's chilly.
Yeah. So we wore socks so that we didn't cut our feet on the rocks, but fingers and toes were definitely numb after being in the water for not very long.
You were still doing training. It wasn't just all let's go take pictures of neat things while you're down there. Did the training part kind of ramp up or change focus at all? I know there was a, you know, particular focus on climate change. So were you looking at anything in Antarctica in the realm of that?
So we definitely saw a lot of evidence of climate change in Antarctica. The people from the Palmer Station had pictures of the glacier behind their station from 1975 and from current. And there's been a dramatic amount of glacier recession around that base in particular. And really throughout Antarctica, there has been a lot of melting ice. And we could see evidence of moss in areas that was exposed rock that hadn't been exposed rock up until recently. Somewhat paradoxically, there's actually quite a lot of snow in the Western Antarctic Peninsula. And it's complicated the way that climate change affects that. But as there's more moisture in the areas farther away from the pole, so around the southern part of South America and Africa, that moisture then dumps onto the western part of Antarctica as the winds cycle across the continent. And so the eastern part of Antarctica is in some ways colder and drier than it's been. And there is more snow on the western part of Antarctica than there has been. So the effects of climate change are complex. Overall, there definitely has been a lot of loss of the ice sheets and warming of the oceans, and there's concern about what that will do to the krill and some recent research about changing age of the krill populations, and the whales and the penguins all depend on krill. So there definitely are concerns about change in the food web. You asked about kind of what was the program about. The one thing that we did on board that we didn't do beforehand, there was a scientific program where we all learned from each other's science. So there was a 3-minute limit symposium at sea where we all presented about the kinds of science that we do back home. So we learned a lot from each other in that. And then we had organized into groups of science themes. So there was a global health group, there were pollution groups, there were groups that presented their research, and also a group about gender issues. And so looking at a variety of issues of representation of women in leadership and in science particularly. So we spent a lot of time learning from each other on board.
So were you part of that global health initiative?
I was.
I would think that would be fascinating to take your experience in Alaska and kind of compare and contrast what's similar in other areas of the world, what's different in other areas of the world. Did anything in that surprise you, or did you learn anything or reinforce anything that you'd kind of thought before that you hadn't had access to previously?
So I think there definitely are some links between, we called ourselves bipolar people, but so people at the northern and the southern latitudes, and how we definitely have some things in common. There aren't any permanent human populations in the south, but around there were a number of women from Iceland, and there were people from Denmark and some other northern countries, so not just Alaska in terms of thinking about northern issues. I think as the rate of climate change affects the poles more quickly than it does towards the equator, we face issues of rising sea levels and melting ice and loss of sea ice in the Arctic sooner than particularly urban groups might notice those things. And so some of the relocation of Alaskan villages that's being actively looked at is, I think, was a surprise to other people on the ship, that people kind of hadn't realized that climate change was actually affecting people's housing within Western countries. I think people are aware that small island nations definitely are at risk, but sort of thinking about how that affects marine-based economies in Alaska, I think, was news to a lot of people. And the issues of drying and of forest fires and of respiratory disease that goes along with that, I think those questions are relatively widespread, but we're seeing a lot of that in Alaska.
What happens from here now? You were back. You can't just be done, turn it all off, right? What happens now that you've returned?
So one of the things that we did on board ship was to develop 100-day plans and sort of think about, you know, what is our intermediate term? What are our goals? What are we committing to do? What are our aspirational things that we'd like to work on? And we're definitely holding each other accountable about those goals. And it's really been exciting to see that we're someone who'd been unemployed for 6 months on board ship and had really thought a lot about, you know, what was she willing to settle for, and that she really had decided she needed to do what she was passionate about and find work in the field that she loved. And I just got a message from her this morning that she got a job working with two researchers that she's really inspired by. And so that kind of ongoing development within the group is something that has been exciting and fun to see, and I think we'll continue. And for myself, I think there's been a real shift for me in thinking about trying to think optimistically about the role that we can have in terms of the climate, and not being discouraged and overwhelmed about what a big project that is, but thinking about what are the things that we can individually do to try and live more lightly in terms of the carbon footprint, and try and communicate with the networks that we already have about how can we spread that effect over a broader group. So I just had the experience of talking at the Kaleidoscope School of Arts and Sciences, and kids as young as kindergarten have lots of ideas about reducing waste and picking up garbage and not trashing the oceans and recycling. And so I'm inspired that there's a lot of energy amongst the youngest members of our community. And I think really there's hope that we can all think a little bit about using the science to inform public policy and make better decisions for ourselves as humans living on this planet.
And you brought a flag? You brought something from Kaleidoscope with you, correct?
I did. So some of the older students at Kaleidoscope were part of a fiber arts project, and so they made a quilt that had symbols that symbolized for them their school and Alaska and some of the things that were important to them, and they put that together and sent it with me to Antarctica. So I had it on my bed on the ship even when I was feeling sick and horrible, and aww, I felt like I had a little connection back to home and Alaska and people who were invested in my having a good journey. So it was a special thing to have with me, and I was really honored to be able to bring it back to them and tell the story of how far it had traveled.
Hopefully it returned clean.
Well, it got soaked in a mud puddle in my luggage at some point. So there was definitely some learning about how sometimes we don't keep our environments as clean as we'd like to, and that affects penguins and whales as well as quilts. And how can we individually take responsibility for trying to pollute less. So kids had lots of good ideas about that.
Way to turn a stain into a teachable moment. What is next from you? What do you think that you're going to take from this program going forward? You mentioned your 100-day plan, and I know you've got some other speaking engagements and whatnot coming up, as well as the one with us on the 28th at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. What are you hoping to kind of parlay this experience into here locally?
So some of it, I think, will just be the way that I approach groups in which I have a leadership role, and thinking about sort of what's the attitude I bring to the room. How do we set up goals? How do we set up expectations for, can we trust each other to bring our best selves to this space and really work constructively? I think will help meetings go better, will help us spend less time getting misdirected and be more effective. So I think that will help me in a variety of professional ways. I am going to be giving a bunch of talks. I think the way that I live with my family in terms of thinking about carbon offsets and consumption will change. And I hope to to just have those conversations with people over time. And I think in my big picture, I think we live in a place that is small enough that we have networks of a variety of people who are influential. And I know that I have sometimes held myself back and thought, well, I'm not really the most qualified person to do this, and someone else should step up. And I think one of the leadership lessons was that oftentimes we undersell what we're able to do and what we're able to bring to the table. So I think that I'm going to be more willing to say, you know, I do know something about this, and I'm willing to be part of a conversation and lend my voice to things, particularly around public policy. And thinking about, Kim, are there ways that we can have science inform our policy at a local level, at a state level, at a national level, thinking in terms of medicine and then in terms of other health policy as well.
Great. Well, welcome back. And we will all, I'm sure, welcome your involvement further in the community on these issues. And if other folks are interested in Homeward Bound in either your cohort or the program in general, what are ways that they could find out more?
So there is a website that is called homewardboundprojects.au for Australia.com. If you search Homeward Bound, you come up with a lot of Homeward Bound movie sites. So searching for Homeward Bound Antarctica is a more successful way to do that.
Not a dog and a cat with a journey across the... Was that the movie?
There's definitely a dog, and I haven't seen the movie recently. Anyhow, I'm sure it's an inspiring movie, but it's not the same thing as the project that I went on.
There was lots of moving music and some sunset. I have a vague memory of... Yeah, different thing.
Right. So search Homeward Bound Antarctica or Homeward Bound Australia. And there is recruitment right now for the fifth cohort out of 10, and there will be an annual cohort after this until we get to year 10. And any woman who has a link to science, technology, engineering, math, medicine, who is interested in being part of the conversation, I would encourage you to go to the website and check it out.
All right. And if you want more visual inducement to do so, Dr. Mitchell is going to be showing photos from her trip at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. Part of our Adventure Talks series. So if you are a KDLL member, it's free admission. Otherwise, it's $5. And thank you so much for doing that. We're really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to sharing some of my photos from the journey with the community. Thank you, Jenny.
And thanks for being here today. And that will do it for KDLL Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. Coming up at 11 a.m., it's On Point, followed by PRI's The World at noon, with World Cafe at 1 p.m., Fresh Air at 3, NPR's All Things Considered at 4, and the KDLL Evening News with Shailen Cochran at 5:20. We've got Alaska Nightly News at 6 p.m. and Marketplace at 6:30, followed by our local DJ show. Tune in to hear late, still great artists on Dead Musicians with Sal Cassano from 7 to 9 p.m. And you can find previous Adventure Talks programs on the show page at kdll.org. Thanks for tuning in. It's pick, click, give time for Alaskans. When you file for the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, you can support your favorite nonprofit organizations. Do you value public radio? Donations help KDLL provide the news, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Apply for your dividend at pfd.alaska.gov by March 31st and pick, click, give to help your favorite organizations. Thanks.